Welcome to the College Commons Podcast and our acclaimed author series, a partnership between HUC Connect, the online learning platform of the Hebrew Union College, and the Jewish Book Council, featuring conversations with authors recognized by the National Jewish Book Awards. My name is Joshua Holo, your host.
Welcome to the College Commons Podcast and our conversation with Professor Hannah Pauline Galai. Hannah Pauline Galai is the Penn Tishkach Professor of Holocaust Studies and the head of the Institute for Holocaust, Genocide, and Memory Studies at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. In 2018, she authored Ecologies of Witnessing, Language, Place, and Holocaust Testimony. And in 2024, she published Occupied Words, which came out from the University of Pennsylvania Press, in which Pauline Galai unveils how the Holocaust radically altered the Yiddish language, operating as a form of Holocaust memory. Occupied Words won the Holocaust National Jewish Book Award in memory of Ernest Mitchell. And we want to thank you, Professor Pauline Galai, for joining us on the College Commons Podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm really glad to be here.
The term that serves as the fulcrum of your book, Occupied Words, is a term that you coined called Churban Yiddish. What is Churban Yiddish, and what is the enduring lesson that you've derived about its preservation and analysis?
Literally, the term means destruction Yiddish. Churban in Yiddish is the same as Churban in Hebrew, which is an important term in describing historical Jewish catastrophes, Churban HaBayit, the destruction of the First and Second Temple. And there is no exact equivalent for the word Holocaust in Yiddish. There were lots of different terms that people used during the event that was not called the Holocaust to describe what was going on with them. The closest thing to one word that would describe the entire catastrophe is Churban. And you do find that in writings and in discussions in real time and immediately afterwards. There are a lot of compound words with that Churban also. Churban Forschung, destruction research. Churban Literatur, destruction literature. So I thought that it would be a culturally appropriate extension of their own language to come up with this term and call it Churban Yiddish to designate this as the subcategory of Yiddish as we know it that would describe what happened to Yiddish there, that it was really more than just a couple of terms that were added here and there. It was really a holistic phenomenon that created a sub-language that we could call a type of sociolect, a strain of the language that existed for a specific period of time. And the interesting part about this term, though, is whether or not there is a dash in the middle. So is it Churban Yiddish, meaning destruction dash Yiddish, or is it the destruction of Yiddish? Because in Yiddish, you have these compound words and you don't really know if there should be an of there or not. And that's a very profound question that one of my students asks me. Is this the destruction of the language? Did Nazis, did the Holocaust not just destroy Yiddish speakers, but did they desecrate the language itself? And is that what I'm studying? Like, am I dissecting a cadaver of a language in analyzing these terms? Or am I doing something else? Is this destruction dash Yiddish, meaning a modality of expression that could be quite lively and productive, but is linked to destruction? And I ultimately come out on the side of the dash, destruction dash Yiddish, Churban Yiddish, meaning this is not the end of the story that I'm telling. These words are born of torment, starvation, imprisonment, loss, trauma, but actually they become a new modality of speech and creativity that does continue to allow the language and culture to exist. So that is part of the work that went into selecting that term and deciding over the course of many years what I meant by it.
There is a grand lexicographic divide far beyond the realm of Judaism or Yiddish between two philosophies, prescriptive and descriptive. sometimes associated with the European continental languages, the prescriptive goal of dictionaries and languages is to standardize and elevate a given language. Meanwhile, sometimes associated with the English tradition, descriptive lexicography tries to capture a language as used in real life in all its irregularity and dynamism. Herben Yiddish seems like the descriptive approach. Is it? And if so, why?
There are multiple approaches to Herben Yiddish. I tried to describe and analyze those different approaches. And yes, I attempted to be descriptive. I have ideas that Herben Yiddish is a modality of expression. It has a moral value for us today. But I am not naive in thinking that everyone who spoke about Herben Yiddish or wrote about Herben Yiddish during the war or after was doing so merely passively. And I actually think that most dictionaries or studies of words are some combination of prescriptive and descriptive. They're somewhere along that continuum. So let me tell you about these three different main lexicographers that I allow to lead the book as kind of protagonists to take us through at least two-thirds of the book. They each have different approaches and different answers to your question, and those answers are quite significant, I think. So one is Nachman Blumenthal, who was born in 1902. He's from Warsaw. He studied philology and philosophy in the Warsaw University, and he comes from this incredibly lively and experimental intellectual moment in Warsaw, and he is interested in psycholinguistics, in the psychology of art, and in the psychology of speech. After the war, he comes back from the unoccupied Soviet Union. He's shocked at the Yiddish that he hears. And he starts asking questions like, do these words come from the body? A suffering body has to produce different sounds than a healthy body. He publishes his work initially, starting in the 1950s, that he keeps working on all the way until 1981, because he just keeps collecting more and more words and describing them. In this act of tremendous description and aggregation, he is saying, this is how we are a people. This is how we have something in common. You think Yiddish is destroyed and scattered and no one will ever see each other again. He writes this actually shortly after he starts his language studies. People are on wheels. No one's ever going to see each other again, but the words are going to keep us together. So his description, there is a normative thrust to it, and that makes it somewhat prescriptive. The other two are, one is Elie Spivak, who's a little older, born in the end of the 19th century in Kiev, and he is a Soviet. So he's trained in the Marxist linguistic tradition, which is very sophisticated. His interwar articles are incredibly smart about Marx and Engels and language, and he describes language as the first tool of expressing your conscience to the outside world, which I love. And he's openly prescriptive, but I really respect his form of prescription, the way that he attempted it and what he believed in, because he said, if you think that language is passive, anything goes, that's equivalent to social Darwinism. Survival of the fittest is something we would not accept in a society. And social Darwinism is wrong, and therefore linguistic Darwinism is also wrong. We can't just let the strongest languages win. And that's his argument for Yiddish. And he took that to Herben Yiddish also. So Spivak is openly saying, here's what's going to happen. Here are the words that came out of the war. There are new words in Yiddish for heroism from Jewish Red Army soldiers. And there are new words for destruction. And the two are going to come together in a dialectic form. And we're going to have a new future Yiddish. So he's quite open about his prescriptive approach. And unfortunately, that prescriptive approach turned on him, and that other Soviets said, well, yes, we always prescribe what happens in language and in research, and we've decided that you have prescribed it wrong, so you have to go to prison. And he died during interrogations. The third one is kind of a wild card, and I love him, Yisrael Kaplan. He didn't really have a theory. He was a survivor himself. He was in the Kovno ghetto and various smaller camps and then in Dachau. And he was declared dead shortly before liberation. He was a Musulman, as the people around described him. And he threw himself into this project as an act of survival, as an act of healing. And he didn't have a stated theory behind what he did. And he's going on instinct. He's rebuilding himself in a way. So I guess that's a form of prescription. But what did he do to the words? You know, everybody did some editing, some selecting. He wanted things to be funny. I could see in the drafts that I was able to look at of the dictionaries that he edits for comic timing, you know, making this definition a little shorter, moving this word over here, over there, so that he can take you and me on a tour through the Kovno ghetto with a smirk on his face. That was his prescription. It's funny, and there's something incredibly deep about that humor in that I see it truly as his way of rediscovering and recovering himself in the process. So in the mix of those three and their different places on the continuum between prescription and description, and there are very high moral stakes in the question that you've asked, I tried to respect those different places to describe them while also coming out and saying, I do have my own idea about why this is a good idea to record these words and why we should know about them today. So I also come out with a little prescription of my own.
Can you give us an example of a Complainian humorous term or definition?
Yeah, sure. There are a lot of fake acronyms in Churban Yiddish because the Nazis loved acronyms. So did the Soviets. Acronyms are a form of power because only people on the inside know what all these letters stand for. So there are a lot of fake acronyms, sometimes making fun of the Nazis, you know. And one that Kaplan points out and highlights is NDM. Now, ND sounds like National Demokrat, you know, like another Nazi term, right? And then he defines it, nicht dein Masel, you're shit out of luck. So he finds that humor and amplifies it in the way that he sets up his dictionary page.
The College Commons podcast belongs to HUC Connect, the online platform for continuing education from the Hebrew Union College. HUC Connect includes webinars, syllabi for community learning, and masterclasses for HUC alumni, with interviews, expert panels, and classroom materials on topics ranging from the arts to civil society, Israel, and much more. Check us out at huc.edu/HUC Connect. Now, back to our interview.
In your introduction, you argue that dictionaries have a paradoxical quality because on the one hand, they deracinate a language and kind of plots it down, if nothing else, because the dictionary assumes that the user doesn't know something about the language. But on the other hand, you point out that dictionaries also crack the language open and allow access to the language. My thoughts go in a different direction, that access to a body of knowledge requires a priori curiosity, and curiosity in turn presupposes ignorance. And so I wonder if there's the possibility that there's no alienating aspect to dictionaries at all, and therefore no paradox, but really only access and discovery.
Yeah, that is interesting. The earliest known dictionary in human history is a Chinese dictionary called the Arya. I'm not pronouncing it perfectly. Arya, which as I understand it, means progress towards perfection. And I found that a very insightful origin story for dictionaries, that we're going to look at a dictionary to learn something new, to perfect our knowledge of our native language, to improve our knowledge of another language, of a specialty language. But we're not going to get there. It's progress towards, it's not a rival. And I think that helped me to really deeply consider what is going on in these Churban Yiddish dictionaries? You know, I spent so many months, years reading these dictionaries. I couldn't come out of it and just say, I just looked through a very boring reference source. That was not my experience as a reader. I'm going on these choreographed visits to a different world. And so I wanted to try to come up with a scholarly way of reflecting on that experience of reading and researching, and to assert that it was more than just an edifying list of items. That was for my own sake. And I also wanted to do that reflection on the dictionary genre to better understand the historical subjects, the people about which I'm writing, because these are very smart people. They can write anything they want. They can write poetry. They can write novels. They can write chronologies. They can do document studies. Why did they choose dictionaries? And by they, I mean the three lexicographers I just named, as well as many, many other people who wrote small word lists in real time in the Warsaw Ghetto. There's Rabbi Shimon Hubelband, who sits down. He just lost his wife and his child, and everything around him is chaotic and crumbling. And he writes a list of words, new words, and old words with new meanings. Neue Wörter und alte Wörter mit neue Begriffungen. And or Rochel Euerbach, the eminent journalist, leader, scholar from the Warsaw Ghetto, in her early post-Holocaust writings, she appends a short glossary to what she's doing. There are short dictionary columns in displaced person camp newspapers that are printed on cheap paper. So it was a popular genre and a popular form of self-expression. So I wanted to give these historical subjects the respect that they deserved and saying they didn't just happen to use this. There was something that drew them to it, and their inner need to witness and witness in a certain way that the dictionary offered. And what was that? It's not narrative. You don't have to have a beginning, middle, and an end. You don't have to have a conclusion. A word, when you see it in a dictionary, it's lifted out of your instinctive patterns of use and set aside on a pedestal, and it's asking you to marvel at it. It's like a museum piece. And that act of marveling, it then also awakes curiosity, and it tells you, you can come close to this, but you can't get there because the dictionary never ends. And I think that's maybe a very effective and rewarding way to witness the Holocaust, because people, you know, they want to share. They want to say that something happened to them, but they don't necessarily have a conclusion, or they don't know where to start. So I'm not sure if it's a paradox or it's a multi-directional mode of witnessing that the dictionary offers us.
So I want to drill down a bit on this idea of a museum piece that you mentioned mm-hmm. just now, and this dual meaning of the term Churban Yiddish. When it means destruction Yiddish, that is the form of Yiddish that evolved during and out of the destruction of the Holocaust, it's Yiddish grammar. However, when one reads it as Churban Yiddish, meaning the destruction of Yiddish, that's Hebrew grammar, where the Churban is in basically smichut, in possessive, with the term Yiddish. And from this point of view, Churban Yiddish marks what seems to me like a mid-20th century crossroads. And at that crossroads, Hebrew is emerging from the limited, even precious world of fixed forms, ancient study, and ritual utterances into the real world of dynamic, living, useful, daily language. Meanwhile, in the same period, at this crossroads, Yiddish is cloistering itself from the vibrancy of the Jewish home and street into the display case of history, protected but also confined in such things as the Churban Yiddish dictionaries. What does it mean? Does it mean that the display case of Churban Yiddish is an entombment of the language, that the Hurban Yiddish dictionaries actually kind of embalm? Alternatively, is it a display case that necessarily allows Hurban Yiddish to recede from the living world a bit, but also yields psychic space to the language of resuscitation, namely Hebrew, as perhaps personified in the figure of Kay Tsentnik, whom you describe? Or is it our cultural bank account, whereby we keep our language safe, that is Yiddish, we keep it documented in dictionaries and remembered, perhaps even revered, for us to call on another day in the spirit of the person you introduced us to, Chava Rosenfeld? Or is it something different altogether?
Thank you. That's a really good question. Let me start by giving a little bit of how I see the relationship between Hebrew and Yiddish from the Holocaust through the 1960s or so forth. With the big Aliyah Gdola, there are millions of Yiddish speakers in Israel, and they are speaking Yiddish. That's documented. When you do kind of history from the ground up, you see chapbooks that were sold on the street corners in Yiddish, including about the Holocaust. You hear family stories and oral histories, how much people were speaking Yiddish. So it's really not a moment when Yiddish recedes, not in the way that people live. It recedes in the resources that it's being given. It recedes because there are no new Yiddish speakers being produced in Eastern Europe, because the communities in Eastern Europe have been killed. And in that sense, it's suppressed. And then there's the second assertion that the person who asserts it the strongest is the linguist Gilad Zuckerman, who writes about Hebrew as Israelit. He has a book, Israelit Safa Yafa. Israeli is a beautiful language. And he says that this is really, it's Semitic, it's Hebraic casings, the words, but the grammar and the cadences and the sentence structures of modern Hebrew are highly, highly influenced by other languages, prominently among them Yiddish. And so Yiddish doesn't really disappear or go into a museum as much as it breathes into this new emerging language. That's on a general scale. Now I'll go back to Churban Yiddish. And this does cause problems for Yiddishists in Israel. They don't really know what to do. So let's say you are Yankov Zerubbabel and you're a member of a small left coalition in Israel, in the Yishuv in Palestine, before the founding of the State of Israel. And you've been making this case that Yiddish is a proper language, it's a beautiful language, it's an upright language, and this new emerging state needs to incorporate Yiddish on an official level because Yiddish is a clean language, it has books and grammar and a school system, and is capable of doing the work of a state just as good as any other language. And then you go back to Poland in 1946, and you hear people speaking Churban Yiddish. And it sounds awful, and it sounds disgusting. And they're using words like szabrowin, which means to loot, but not quite to loot. And nobody knows if it's a compliment or not a compliment to say that someone's a szabrownik. And you hear words like Katzetnik, which later became the pen name of the author, which is the German acronym KZ for Konzentrationslager Nick. So somebody that's from a concentration camp is a Katzetnik, almost like a term of pride that they survived. You're hearing all of these words, and he's disgusted. And he says, that's it, it's bankrupt. And he writes a chapter in his book about that with the title, Bankrot, Bankrupt, We Gotta Get Out of Here, This Is Over. This is the destruction of Yiddish. That was his claim. It didn't mesh with his plan for integrating and elevating Yiddish in Israel at that moment, in Palestine and then in Israel. That's one perspective, but that's not the only perspective. What was going on with, you know, the three lexicographers that I mentioned was that they weren't producing these choreographed visits to Churban Yiddish in order to drag the language down. They wanted post-war Yiddish to be authentic, to be real. I mean, think about the billions of articles that we read in the New York Times that analyze you know, why Joe Rogan is successful and why people love those podcasts, and Democrats could never have a podcaster that's as fun as them. Part of their claim is, I'm not saying this is my claim or I agree with it, is that people enjoy hearing authentic language. And I think that Churban Yiddish lexicographers wanted to uplift Churban Yiddish, first of all, because they wanted the truth to be known about the Holocaust, but also because they thought this is how the language is going to be lively, to give people permission to speak as they spoke during this event, give people permission to remember what happened to them. And that's authenticity, and authenticity leads to vibrancy. And the proof is in the pudding. In the literature, the novels and the poetry that incorporated Churban Yiddish, and you mentioned Chava Rosenfarb, and what she does with Churban Yiddish words is the opposite of entombment. It's not nailing these words down into a coffin and burying them for something else, you know, to grow on top of. It's the opposite. She writes this incredibly imaginative, forward-looking literature that takes the real Churban Yiddish words and makes art out of them. There are lots of examples, but let me tell you about my favorite one. It's my favorite because it involves my name, Chanale, which was a real Churban Yiddish word in the Lodz Ghetto. It's in the Lodz Ghetto Encyclopedia. It's in all the dictionaries and so forth. I'll tell you what it means, first of all. Chanale in the Lodz Ghetto was wood chips that were stolen from a tram car, taken from scrapped furniture for firewood to keep people warm in the winter and to cook food. Chanale, so my name meant, you know, wood scraps. How did it get there? There's different stories. Most likely is that they called stealing wood chalenemen, taking challah, like tearing off a piece of challah dough during baking for ritual purposes. And then chalenemen became too familiar and they switched challah to chane. Whatever the story behind it, Chava Rosenfarb goes back. And she takes this historically authentic word and she writes this book over the course of many decades. So it's like probably the 60s by the time she writes this. And she's looking at today. She's looking forward. She's looking at feminism, at women's rights. And she's going back and saying, every time the wood thieves stole a chanale, they would remember the women who polished the furniture and the mothers who took care of the Jewish homes. You see, so she makes the word into an archive of women's memory, but she also is filling that archive not just with the memory of the Holocaust and of the people who were destroyed before then, but with a new forward-looking lens, meaning why don't we remember these women? I, in the 1960s, now feel empowered to remember women in a way that people might not have earlier. So I'm going to take Chanale and I'm going to give it a mix, a little old, a little new. It's got Holocaust history and it's got feminism. And the word takes her forward. It's a vision of what could be next for the Jewish people, for Jewish women. And so Kotzetnik, his message is not as uplifting. He's more of a verbal insurrectionist. And he takes Churban Yiddish words, he makes them provocations, and he angers people, but he does it for the sake of something new, for a different reality. And in that sense, the literature, which is actually the last third of my book, and that's why I put it at the end, so that we would end with the texts that take these Churban Yiddish words to go forward, to look at what's next, to envision a new future, because they do have that potential as well. So yes, there is an archival thrust to studying Churban Yiddish, and it's about having that archive and knowing the past and knowing it in a factual way, for sure. And there's nothing to be ashamed of about that. We need that. And that's me speaking in normative terms, for sure. But there is also a future-facing vision within the Churban Yiddish project as I see it. And Chava Rosenfarb articulates that. She says, these words and the way that I use them, it's about teaching love. It's about offering, and she calls it unser allemens Eigentum, a new a state for everyone, a new cultural commons, a new way to come together as a people through the act of remembering and through the act of reinterpreting for the sake of the future. So my answer is, in this sense, two part. One, I guess I challenge us to think about the way that Hebrew and Yiddish interacted in this crucial mid-century moment as not clear-cut either or, but actually a very intense interaction and influence of Yiddish on Hebrew and vice versa. And then secondly, that the work of remembering can be incredibly forward-facing when it comes to Chorban Yiddish.
I'd like to close out our interview with a general question about language and identity. Cultural movements the world over have clung to language as the symbolic soul of identity. I'm thinking not only, for example, of the Irish or Welsh languages and their efforts at resuscitation of those languages, but also diasporic languages like Greek, Armenian, and of course, Hebrew. For the purposes of this thought experiment, let's stipulate that language is indeed the soul of identity. What, therefore, other cultural expression or activity would you call the heart of identity?
So it's interesting that you would ask that. My current project is on nature, on the physical world, and how Holocaust survivors and victims, especially, how did they see, touch, and live with trees, land, sand, mice, bugs, sewage, clouds, rain, on that very literal level? There is something out there besides words. There are things, there are material entities. There is a lot of physicality in the book that I just wrote, and then I talk about the relationship between bodies and language. But I wanted to ask about earth and about the Jewish quest to be earthly in this historical juncture. And I see it as something that's very, very real. There were these Yiddish adjacent know the land movements in the interwar period, like Landkenntnis, which means knowledge of the land in interwar Poland. We've been denied the right to consider ourselves stewards of the earth, to know about trees, to enjoy them, to farm. Let's change that in a very purposeful, secular way. Part of this is secularism, right? You know, knowing the earth that way. But that's not the only place where it comes up also. If we change our lens, I think that there's a lot more curiosity and earthliness in Hasidism, in various yeshiva practices of hisboididis, isolation in the woods, in recovering those modalities of Jewish earthliness. I am also admitting that there were limitations on it. It's not that Jews had full and equal access to land, and they were subjected to stereotypes of the unnatural Jew. So there's a both and in that. And that is also, like you say, what's out there besides language. That is there. So it's a new and fresh challenge for me. And I hope that I'm able to share something with people on this eventually.
We'll look forward to the conversation then. And until then, Hannah Pullen-Galai, thank you so much for joining us on the College Commons podcast. Congratulations on your award. And it was really a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the College Commons Podcast, available wherever you listen to your podcasts. And check out HUC Connect, compelling conversations at the forefront of Jewish learning. For more information about all that HUC Connect has to offer, visit huc.edu/HUC Connect.